Hello, and welcome to Marching On. I'm Micah Kubik, Executive Director of the ACLU of Kansas, and we thank you for listening. You know, protecting voting rights goes far beyond words on a piece of paper. Merely having the right to vote does little to ensure that you're truly able to make your voice heard in the democratic process. In fact, the distinction between the two is a tale as old as time. For example, poll taxes and literacy tests, those old tools used to disenfranchise African Americans in particular, were really about being able to say that people had the right to vote on paper while ensuring they weren't able to vote in practice. The work to ensure that the right to vote isn't just words on a page, but rather a practical reality, very much continues to this day. It takes the form of voter registration requirements, policies around vote by mail, voter ID requirements. But it also takes shape in one particular way that is the subject of this month's podcast, and that's language access. There are over 50,000 people living in Wyandotte County, Kansas, who speak a primary language other than English. Despite this fact, the election office there only makes most voting materials available in English, severely limiting the ability of people to participate in our democracy. Now, there's a federal law that requires some counties to provide all election materials in translation, but Wyandotte County falls through the cracks of that law because of some quirks in the formula that the federal government uses. It could still choose to make materials available in languages other than English, the way several other counties do, and that's because you're allowed to do good things even when the law doesn't require it. We're not alone in asking for language access in Wyandotte County. We stand alongside organizations and advocates working in the community, including a couple of whom we'll hear from in a moment, thousands of Wyandotte County residents who signed a petition imploring the election office to take action, and even the Wyandotte County Board of Commissioners, who unanimously passed a resolution asking the county election office to provide voting materials in Spanish. So in this episode, we're going to take a deeper look at the issue of language access and the work to make it a reality in Wyandotte County. To do so, we'll listen into a conversation led by our communications manager, Jesse Keelman, who's joined by voting rights organizer Evan Altman, as well as Carla Juarez, executive director of AIR, and Erika Andrade, the president and CEO of El Centro. After their conversation, we'll hear a little bit from Judith Silvestri and Tom Alonzo, two advocates who have been embedded in the organizing and community work around this issue. So, without further ado, let's throw it over to Jesse, Evan, Carla, and Erika.
Wyandotte County is one of the most racially diverse counties in Kansas. Over 60% of residents identify as non-white, and over 50,000 community members speak a primary language other than English. Despite this, voting materials are still only offered in English, and as the fourth largest county in the state, this has a disproportionate effect on the barriers it creates for would-be voters. As Micah mentioned up top, we have an awesome group here to share more on the work of language access in Wyandotte. Rather than try to give a glancing overview myself, I thought it'd make much more sense to allow each of you to introduce yourselves properly. So, Erika, I'm going to start with you. Can you share a little bit more about yourself, the history and mission of El Centro, and how and why you got involved in community organizing?
Sure. My name is Erika Andrade, president and CEO of El Centro. At El Centro, we're about to celebrate our 49th year, so we're pretty close to the big 5-0. So El Centro was created primarily as a tool to fight against racism in the 70s. There was an increasing Latino population in Wyandotte County specifically, with workers coming up to work on the railroad, and there was no Spanish services at that time. So El Centro was created very much specifically to address those gaps in accessing different things, education, healthcare, and just information for individuals coming into the community. And so that's why we were created. And since then, our programs have, you know, changed with the coming of the times and the needs of the community. But there's certain core things that will always be true. First, El Centro is a Spanish-first organization. What that means for us is that everything we do, from education to communication to any of our contacts with the community, are done in Spanish first. Sometimes they're translated into English, and honestly, sometimes they're not, because not all of our services are provided in both languages. We do work around early childhood education with a dual language preschool. We do work around health access with health navigation and other health access services, as well as enrollment services for families in Spanish. And then we do a lot of economic empowerment, understanding banking, raising your credit, owning a home, filing your taxes, all of those services, again, done in Spanish. And then, of course, the thread that runs through all of our program, as we call it, which is our advocacy. And we started doing advocacy work, honestly, because that's why we were created. So many injustices happening with our community, so many ways that they're not listened to or taken into consideration, policies that are hurtful to our community. And so we see it as a great responsibility that we have to be able to, A, understand our community, understand what their needs are, and then make sure that we're amplifying their voices and not speaking for them. That's super important. And we know that that's a big responsibility. And that's why we've built almost 50 years of trust with community and be able to advocate for a lot of things that are injustices or that we need more access to and things like that. And so we take that very seriously.
And what area, what region do you work in?
We have a location in Wyandotte County, and then we also have an office out in Olathe in Johnson County. However, we just recently, a few months back, hired our first part-time individual in Garden City, Kansas, and we do have a group of promotoras out there. Eventually, our hope is to bring all of the services that we do here to Western Kansas as well.
That's so exciting. That's really cool. Congrats on the growth there.
Thank you.
Carla, can you tell us more about AIR?
Yes. My name is Carla Juarez, Executive Director of AIR. AIR was born in 2006 under another name. I can't remember it. It was a terrible acronym I hear. It became AIR in 2010. And so we've been here since. Every nonprofit's programs and areas of focus change as the community needs change as well. So we adapt. We have to. We just adopted our new vision and mission. AIR advocates, organizes, and mobilizes the immigrant community and the community in general in Kansas and Missouri towards immigrant rights, so making it more welcoming. And our vision is essentially so AIR does not need to exist. You know, our work is so important that we want to work ourselves out of a job, that our immigrant community is rights are respected and they live a dignified life. That's a little bit of us.
You know, my favorite iterations of Batman have the same philosophy. Yeah. If I've done my job right, then I won't have to do my job now because it'll be restored. It'll be all better. So maybe not the comparison that everyone makes, but I think you're like Batman in all the best ways. So thank you for being here. Evan, I'm going to turn to you next. I won't make you give us a full history of the ACLU. Instead, I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you got involved with organizing and maybe some of your favorite parts or aspects.
Yeah, so I got into organizing on the partisan side during college. I loved working campaigns, moving all over the place, working for candidates that shared my values. I just fell in love with it. You know, I didn't work for too many winning candidates. So that, you know, doesn't really stick with me. But what sticks with me, no matter what community I was in, there were 2, 3, 4 people that at the very beginning didn't think that they had any power, and kind of mentoring them and guiding them as they realize that power is what sticks with me, is what keeps me doing the job. Because organizing can be tough. You guys know, and we don't win every campaign. And with every success, there is inevitably 3 setbacks, you know, around that success. But it's the, for me anyway, it's the people that really rise up to the occasion and realize that they do have power, and that power can truly change their community. So that's why I do it. That's why I'll do it for the rest of my life. So
I'm thankful for that. Thank you so much for sharing that, Evan. Awesome. Carla, I'll jump back to you.
I wanted to share a little bit more about our mission and the programming that we do.
Please.
We focus a lot on education, leadership development, and community-driven action. So it talks about, you know, organizing the immigrant community towards action in our advocacy campaigns and education, like Know Your Rights. So we also do Know Your Rights, focus solely on immigration, know how to defend yourself against federal agents, specifically ICE. And we're seeing a lot of the throughout the years, but I think more now in the news, how people's rights are just being ignored. How did I get into organizing? Naturally, I'm an immigrant. So since I was 14, 15 years old, I grew up in Albuquerque. And my mom was very involved in the community as well as she is now. But back then, she used to be involved in community meetings at an organization similar to AIR in Albuquerque. They would organize neighborhood meetings or just like leader meetings. And I would attend. I didn't know what was going on. And so my first protest that my mom helped organize across the city was May Day. And so that's how I got my first, I would say I consider myself like since then because of my mom. And then just naturally fighting for your own rights as an undocumented college student myself. So it wasn't until I moved to Kansas City where I found out about AIR and other organizations, got a lot more involved with the Safe and Welcoming campaign. So yeah, that's how I got into organizing.
Sounds like you almost found out what it was. You're like, oh, that's what I've been doing this whole time?
Yeah, that's what it's called. Yeah.
Exactly. I love that it's a continuation of your mom's work too in a lot of ways. Yeah. That feels very beautiful.
I get it from my mom.
Erica, did you want to share more about how you got involved?
Sure, because it was actually very organically and before I knew what I was doing it, and I really didn't realize that that's what it was either. I've worked at El Centro a very long time, 23 and a half years. And so El Centro's always done a lot of advocacy work, going to Topeka, things like that. I never saw any of that at advocacy, as obviously it was. But I think where the advocate in me really grew, I would say, it was based on health access. So for many years, I did direct client work. So I was a health navigator at El Centro. I started then a health navigation program we do. So I did a lot of work helping people find access to healthcare, right? And so doing that work, you see all these injustices happening to people because of policies that are written that are very harmful to people, that exclude them from accessing healthcare, something so vital. And so really that's what fired me up. And a topic in particular was cancer care and how the immigrant community or individuals that are uninsurable are just not able to have that access based on policies from local entities. And so I started doing a lot of work advocating for those policies to change, you know, demanding to have a seat at the table with, you know, VPs of medical systems and things like that to try to convince them to change their policies, which is really difficult. And most of the time, not successful. And so I would say that's really what fired me up. My heart is always with especially healthcare access.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm excited to dive in a little bit more on language access. Evan, I'm going to turn to you to get the ball rolling on that, if that's okay. I'd love to hear more about how this went from a noticed issue to action and how that came together.
You know, the official campaign started a little bit, you know, before I arrived here. March of 2023 is when the first coalition got together to have this meeting to express the need for language access. We're in March 20, so 2 years, and we're still fighting for it. But there's a lot of stuff that has happened in those 2 years. And without the help of coalition partners like El Centro, like AIR, Brianna with the signatures, Ruby with the signatures, without them, you know, a lot of stuff has happened. You know, we first requested a meeting with Michael Abbott and again, before my time, but I believe he turned it down at first. And then we turned up the notch a little bit and then we had that meeting. Very unsuccessful.
Do we remember much about that first meeting and maybe what was said?
Yeah. So one of his statements involved, well, if we provide language access for Spanish speakers, then someone else that has another language is going to sue us. I believe that was one of his main arguments, which is baseless. I don't think we've seen that anywhere else in the state or the country. The election commissioner tells us he will get in contact with the Secretary of State to see what he can do. Nothing comes of it. And so it's a bunch of phone tag, a bunch of emails back and forth.
It's a little different in Wyandotte, right? It's one of, is it 4 or 5 county where the Secretary of State appoints the election commissioner. So when you mentioned the Secretary of State, that's something that would not be the same in Haskell County or another county.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because I think that was another one of his talking points, saying Secretary of State Schwab is my boss. I will do what my boss tells me to do. But, you know, through that whole timeline of frustration, we are still going out into the community. And we are still gaining support. March of 2024, so a year later, is when we sent that letter for our specific policy asks. And that included 10 other organizations that signed on to the letter. And lo and behold, no reply. So we start getting this petition together. We take some time off in the summer to regroup, to rest, rejuvenate. But really around August, again, with the help of AIR and El Centro, we got the petition going, and we had in less than a month over 1,000 community members of Wyandotte County expressed their support in language access. Every event that I went to, overwhelmingly, individuals would be like, we aren't offering this already. Mm-hmm. Why? Mm-hmm. You know, it is such a common sense issue, and it's such a widely supported issue. That petition caught the attention of the mayor. The mayor signed on to the petition. Thank you, Ruby. Yeah. I was like, I gotta get some pictures of that. I was watching. He didn't think twice because, again, he also knows we want more community members to vote. We want more community members to have a say in how their government runs. About a month later, we had that resolution hearing where unanimous vote of support from the Wyandotte County Commission. So everyone supports it, but yet we still don't have it. We are getting closer. And I believe we're really close.
Awesome. I'm curious because you said thank you, Ruby, for the mayor's sign. Is there a story there?
I was kind of nervous, but Ruby, not nervous one bit, walked right up there and he signed it.
Just the petition that everyone else was signing?
Yeah. Yeah. So I had posted the photo of him signing the petition in our Slack, and I think someone else kind of ran with it. And then...
Was that someone else in my department?
There.
I got a call from his chief of staff, Irene Calillo, and she was like, hey, did you hear the mayor signed the petition? So now he wants to do a press conference to make it public. And I was like, well, I think that's amazing. That's great. Let's do it. And so, yeah, it just happened because somebody was brave enough to go up there and just ask him to sign it.
Yeah. And Evan touched on this. I'm really curious to get your guys' insight as well on just the overwhelming support from the community, including community leaders. I just would love to get maybe some insight of how you guys experience that. Do you guys feel the same enthusiasm, the same need? Like, what do you guys feel from the community when you're talking about these issues?
I would say definitely. I think a lot of times you actually get surprised that we're not already doing that, being Wyandotte County, because I know that everybody that's from Wyandotte County understands what a diverse county it is. And that's like one of our greatest assets, I think, and they realize that too. So it's kind of confusing as to why it's not already happening. And then afterwards, it's like, well, tell me more. Why not? And when you start talking about it, then it's almost an immediate, well, that's not fair, or that doesn't make sense. And so it tends to be quite an easy conversation the majority of the time to get people to support and sign on officially.
Yeah, us too. It's like, are we not doing this already? Why are we not doing this already?
Well, that's the perfect segue, because that's the next thing I want to kind of ask about or talk about. A big part of this discussion is that the federal government does have guidelines by which you're then required to provide ballots in languages other than English. But the requirements are additive. So it's one of those things that's odd because we do have four counties in Kansas that qualify and are required, but Wyandotte's not one of those. And it seems largely because of percentage. But with that, the other thing that I find so notable is that there are around 10 Kansas counties that voluntarily provide Spanish language access. So it's this thing of like, we know it's possible because we can point to 10 counties in our state that do it. Mm-hmm. Knowing that you can do it voluntarily, why are we not doing it voluntarily?
I mean, can I say it? Like, voter suppression, racism. Kansas is making it harder for people to vote already. And this is another type of voter suppression to stop people from voting. I mean, that's just clear to me.
Yeah. And, you know, the few people that I did have that were kind of hostile, it's just that hateful rhetoric and those baseless talking points that people hold on to for some reason. You know, most of these immigrants know English, but they would rather vote in the language that they are most comfortable in. And I think if the roles were reversed, we would want that courtesy as well.
And I've said this already. It's like, even if we speak English, Spanish was my first language, is my first language. So even I became a citizen in 2020, even though I mobilized people to vote, register to vote, look at their ballots, all that stuff, I never really got deep into like reading my ballot until I became a voter.
Very complicated.
Yeah. And those amendments, the amendment language, I mean, I was on dictionary.com, right? Like I'm Googling what the word meant, just trying to
dialogue. No, I think it is the intention. I think that this is all rooted in the same place. Whereas in the past, civic engagement was almost demanded of
its citizens, right? You have to be engaged. You have to care about what's going on. It's your responsibility to vote, not just your right. And all of a sudden, it's like there's this shift where, no, we don't want people to vote or be educated enough to vote the way that their values dictate, because then somehow that's going to go against what the powers that be would actually want to have happen. And you're seeing this everywhere, but you're seeing it a lot in Kansas with voter suppression. And this is just another one of those tactics. Language access is not about, it has nothing to do with, like, these are citizens. They have the right to vote. They should have the responsibility to vote. But when an individual that speaks English and only speaks English has a hard time even understanding what amendments say, that's by design. It is designed that way so that people get so confused that they give up or vote the wrong way.
Yeah.
So my thought is that, of course, they're not going to want to put it in Spanish because it might actually be easier to understand for a bilingual person in Spanish than it is in English.
And it feels like we always have these conversations about, like, rights and responsibilities. And it feels like our lawmakers and representatives and bureaucrats get it backwards a lot of times, where they think that the voters have responsibility and the, you know, lawmakers have rights. But it's the other way around. The voters have rights and it's your responsibility. You're the election commissioner. Mm-hmm. Commission some elections here. What are we doing?
It's a responsibility to make sure that every citizen in their district is able to vote that can vote, right? That's what we're supposed to be encouraging people, not making it harder, which is what it feels like the intent has been lately.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I want to kind of freeze into, as we kind of go back through the story, of talking about the resolution from the Wyandotte Unified Government, because that felt substantive to me. So my question is about how you guys experience that as advocates in the community, to then hear the leaders of that community unanimously pass this resolution, which not only represents the will of the people as told by the signatures and all that, but the well-being, I would say unambiguously, of that community. What was that moment like for you guys?
Amazing. I think it was awesome to even hear one of the commissioners say that providing language access is what makes America great, is what he said. He's actually my commissioner.
Yeah, I think for mobilizers, community organizers, and people that do this kind of work, and we're talking about, like, the Briannas and the Rubies of the world, I think it's a great moment for them to have that win, because we so seldomly get wins, let's be honest, in our work. And so moments like that are very special, because it's like you see all of your hard work kind of paying off. And so it's really great to see.
Thank you. I'm curious, can you share more, Carla, on why that resonated with you so much? It's a beautiful sentiment. I just love to hear a little bit more of why it hits you so hard.
Because it's true. I mean, this country is made up of diverse people. This is all of our country, right? This is our community. This is where we live. So it is true that making it easier for people who speak Spanish to vote, and other languages too, but we're focusing in Spanish right now, is what makes this country, this state, this county that we so proudly say is diverse. It's what makes it great.
That was great. Thank you so much, Carla. I mean, that diversity, that inclusion, that unity, being part of what makes America great and beautiful. The flip side of that is that this conversation, it impacts real humans and real communities. And the backdrop to this conversation, and I wondered exactly how I want to say this, but I feel okay with, you know, we're seeing some of the scariest, most blatant racism in my lifetime, for sure. I think in our lifetime. And I think there's something in that I realize how much I just don't see and don't understand as well. So I would really love to hear more about some of the day in, day out experiences in our immigrant and minority communities, and maybe some of the things that people that aren't part of those groups or part of those communities might not understand. And I know that's a super open-ended question, so I hope that's okay.
I have a lot of examples.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, start. I think, like, one of them was my sister works at a clinic, and she's front desk, and she's bilingual, of course, right? So she has her name tag that says, yo hablo español, I speak Spanish. And this patient goes up to her and starts having a casual conversation and asks her when did she arrive to the U.S. and if she has a work permit or a visa. And my sister's a citizen. She was born here. So I think that's one example in an everyday life that I don't get to experience because I work in this space where it feels a little bit safer for me to be in.
I think just in general,
like Carla, I'm lucky that I get to work in an organization that is Latino-led, Latino-serving, and 98% of our staff is Latino.
Yeah.
And all variety of Latinos, you know, immigrant, DACA recipients here on visas, you know, born here. We have a little bit of everything. So we very much represent the community that we live in and that we love. But the fact that people go through those experiences and how those kind of like little microaggressions, we call them, you know, I call them like little cuts. I think that's what the community is going through. But it's 100 times worse than it has been in a really long time. And it's much worse because it has created an environment where it makes behavior like that the norm.
Yeah.
And it should be seen as a norm. Whereas before, people might have had those thoughts, but at least they kept them quiet because it wasn't the norm and it wasn't what a civilized community would do, right? But it's making it okay. And that's the scariest part.
Yeah.
Evan, I'd love to turn to you on anything that you've experienced or anything you've seen. I know you have a little bit different perspective on it, perhaps.
You know, how we treat our immigrants in this country has, for the longest time since college, been like steadfast, my top priority, my top issue that I care about, just because we have leaders in office who are using hate and division, who are using immigrants as the cause to other people's problems. And they have made it very easy for individuals to quickly blame the people that don't look like them, that do different things than them. And it's easy because our leaders are making it acceptable. My faith has demanded that I do the exact opposite. On my street, it is predominantly Hispanic. And, you know, it was always a party at night. Kids playing outside. You don't see that anymore. Just kids running up and down the street. It has always been a hopping street that I've enjoyed living on. But after this election, it kind of shut down. And my partner and I, our neighbors have kids, and they asked if we could take their kids to school for a while. That type of fear that we are instilling on these people, it's not American values. It's not the Statue of Liberty. It is not what we were called to do. But seeing that happen to people and knowing, what can you do about it? It's tough to swallow.
People are really, really scared, are anxious. We don't really talk about the mental health aspect that this has. And aside from that, the mental health, then the access to mental health resources available for our communities is not very much there. Also, like trying to think about our mental health as the staff of these organizations, right? That is one thing after the other. The first weeks of the Trump administration was, I met a man, did not leave his home for 10 days out of fear. And there are still people who will not walk their dog anymore because of the fear. It's also because you're just a brown person, probably a citizen, but you're a brown person and walking down the street and could be asked at any time. And it's just like what Erica said, this behavior is becoming the norm. And then you're also getting fake ICE agents, right? This was on the news. Just like people in rural Missouri actually were, like they were asking for people's papers and they were just random citizens.
I think in Olathe, we had a couple of clients come into our office that got this random letter. It was not an official letter. This is just somebody that decided that this was their civic duty, I guess, to send letters to people with Latino names and talking about, like, we're going to send ICE to your home or something like that. And we had a couple. This was towards the beginning. We haven't had any since then, but we did have those kind of incidents as well, which, again, it's about creating that fear, right? Creating that environment. But it is changing the way Latinos, it's changing the way brown people, it's changing the way immigrants live their lives in America, regardless of their citizenship status, regardless if they were born here or not. I'll give a quick example, too. My family and I are getting ready to take a family vacation down to South Padre Island in Texas. We're originally from Texas, from the Valley. So we'd like to go every summer. My sister still has family with her husband over there. But me and my brother were like, oh, let's go. We'll just go to the beach part, right? We're just happy to go to the beach and get away from here. But I told my brother, I said, make sure you take your passport with you.
And he goes, I'm not going to Mexico. And I'm like, I don't care if you're not going to Mexico. You're taking your passport with you, because on the way back from the valley, you have to pass a checkpoint. And he's very Mexican looking. He's very dark, you know, darker Mexican person. So I was like, you're taking your passport. Mm-hmm. We're not taking any chances anymore. So the little things that all of a sudden now are your first thoughts, even when you're in your own country.
Yeah. And by law, right, people who are not citizens have to carry their immigration paperwork. That's just the law. But even thinking about like being a citizen and having to carry that is just
crazy.
Yeah.
And most of the time we tell people don't carry your passport because you don't want to lose it, right? That's dangerous. Well, now we're telling people you have to carry it and it's expensive.
And that's such a big part of citizenship status. Does not matter if you were born here. I mean, you could.
It doesn't matter.
No. What you can expect doesn't correlate to legal status or any paperwork, but just the color of your skin. Like, we have a word for that. It's called racism.
Yep.
Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing those insights. When we're talking about the norms and the momentum and the way our communities operate, passing language access would be a positive momentum change. It would add to the fabric of how we understand our communities and how we understand civic action. It speaks to larger ideals. Understanding the overwhelming community support, why do you think it's so important that so many people took time out of their day to add signatures? And what community spirit do you think we could use to really make Wyandotte look how the people want it to look?
I would say that expanding language access to the election process in Wyandotte County could be a great first step in really changing the narrative on voting in general, that voting is a positive thing, that we want our citizens to vote because we want Wyandotte County to represent what our citizens want. And what a wonderful first little step to say we're providing language access because voting should be easy. Voting should be something that's accessible to everyone in Wyandotte County that can vote. And we support that. And that's a great first step of saying that to the community.
That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, if that were to happen, if we were to expand language access at the ballot box, it would say that we welcome everybody. And it would send a huge signal and a huge message saying, come live here, stay here. We welcome you.
That's great. Thank you.
There are people, you know, who hate voting. They don't take the time out of it. And they just, you know, don't want anything with that. But I think once they start to see this community stand out and claim their power and demand that they too should be able to vote in the most accessible way for them, this increases voter turnout across the spectrum. It's only a positive. We aren't asking for a lot. We are just asking for people to have a say in their government. That's it.
I love that. I really appreciate you guys talk about some of the fear and the hardship that's happening in the immigrant community. But I kind of want to make sure on the flip side of that, I give a moment to share some of the beauty, what you wish people understood more, saw more of, or thought of more.
It is a good question because I think we focus a lot on the bad and trying to defend ourselves about why we're worth something. And we don't focus on the... It's always good to share the abundance of, like, the beauty of our community. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're partiers. We love music. But, like, deep family-oriented, that's just how much we value our family and just community. Like, when we care for people, we care for people.
Do you see that come through with your community organizing, too?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yes. Yes. Our core team is sort of like that. We're made up of immigrants in our community, or like sons or daughters, children of immigrants. And it's kind of like we don't just get together to work. And Ruby has a big part in this. We get together to also hang out and just talk.
I would just say that, you know, one of the beauties of Wyandotte County is its diversity. And we say that all the time about Wyandotte. I think we know it. But I think we also have to give the respect where it's due, that it's diversity and it's the immigrant community that has really elevated the economy of Wyandotte County. And without them, we would all be hurting. And that's in the whole state of Kansas, I think, and really everywhere. So a lot of times when we have these conversations and when we see these actions taking place that hurt immigrants or other communities of color, we fail to see the other side of what would happen if they really weren't there. We remember what it was 20 years ago when streets were literally dying out. And so we brought this richness in values, in culture, in food, in music, and in business. And so I think those are all really positive, valuable things that have happened in Wyandotte County because of its diversity.
Yeah, natural entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, make it work.
Yes. Like, we want undocumented immigrants to pay taxes, or like this government does, but we don't want to give them a pathway to citizenship.
Or the benefits from those taxes.
Right.
North, yeah.
Yes.
Or even once they become citizens, ballots in Spanish. Yeah. Right. So I'll end it there. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Really appreciate this.
Thanks.
Thank you to Erica, Carla, and Evan for joining us for that conversation. If they've inspired you to take action in your own community, and I know they have, then you should join the ACLU of Kansas Beehive. The Beehive is a great way to create positive change in your community with the support of other Kansans and the guidance of the ACLU of Kansas field team. The next new member orientation for the Beehive is on May 9th, and you can RSVP at aclukansas.org/events. As promised, we end this episode with short segments with Judith Silvestre and Tom Alonzo. Judith was an intern here at the ACLU of Kansas, and Tom is the chair of Equality Kansas. Beyond those roles, though, they have both been active and vocal in the work for language access in Wyandotte County. You'll hear some short vignettes from both of them, and you can find a video where they share even more of their experience on the ACLU of Kansas's social media channels. So let's hear a bit from Judith, followed immediately by Tom.
My family's from Mexico. It's a place called Puebla. I just say Puebla in general because Puebla's like the whole state, but they live in like a very small ranch. It's like maybe like a street. They migrated like 1 year before I was born. So often I would help translate like even important documents. It was like such a big responsibility on me. And sometimes like I would get it wrong and then be like, well, what do we send you to school for? If you're supposed to know English, like why can you not translate? And it's because like often the words were like long terminology or medical terminology words. The language barrier kind of defeats them from actually going out there and learning about politics or about the party they want to vote for. If they like struggle to get their license now, like what would it be when they're eligible to vote? Like I recognized it myself when I went to go collect signatures. Like there's many people who are eligible to vote, even like us who know English, like even my cousin. So he married a Dominican who was born here. And the only way he got to vote is because he had a wife who knew English and who would help him like, hey, like this is how it works here. But because he had a mentor right by his side. So he had someone to like walk him through the path and explain to him, hey, this is how elections work in the United States. You have to do something extra to receive it in the language you prefer. It's funny because it just defeats the purpose of democracy. Silencing a certain population when it should be like everybody should have a say. We're all one. We're all one nation. But when it comes down to like the simple things of like handing out a paper, like you have to make sure it's accessible to that certain group or population. Just because I feel like that opens a sense of an atmosphere, which is like, I would say like welcoming.
You can't be an American if you don't speak English. That's one thing I've always heard since I was a little kid. And my dad wasn't comfortable teaching us Spanish because of what he went through. My grandparents came here probably 1922, 1923. Now, they didn't speak English very well. I think Grandpa could probably speak some. My grandma, she didn't like to because she didn't like, she was self-conscious. They got married and they had 11 kids. So in those days, when my dad and my Aunt Lucy and my Aunt Dolores went to school at John J. Ingalls Elementary on 7th, the Mexican kids had to go to school in the basement, in the boiler room, separate from the other kids, okay? you could only go to eighth grade, and then you had to go to work because that's what Mexicans were good for. You could work, but you didn't need to go to high school. But Dad went in the Navy and served for the duration of the war, which ended in 45, thank God, and in the Pacific Theater, and he was very proud of that. My dad loved a country that didn't always love him. So my dad was Mexican-American. So my mom was white, my dad wasn't. And back in 1950s, that was a no-no around here. When I was a boy, and even as a teenager, I definitely could tell there were places I was welcome and people that welcomed me and others that weren't. They don't want anything to shift that power of what they have now. And you dehumanize people and you get your regular good people, salt of the earth people, to just go along with that. Did you ever stop and look at the history of how many times our government interfered with duly elected independent countries all the way down to the tip of Tierra del Fuego, all over the Caribbean Sea, okay? We used them for their natural resources, for their slave labor, and for economic gain of all kinds without regard to the people that lived there. In fact, dismissing the humanity of the people in those countries. And there's a lot of us here that are descended from those people. Think about everything that they've been through, everything that they've lost. They've left families behind. They've left horrible conditions. What would it be like to go to a country not knowing the language, the customs? How would I navigate all of that? So my thing was, I'm going to help you navigate any way that I can. So with regard to language access, I have enough trouble in English reading those proposals for amendments and whatever, because they do it that way on purpose. Can you imagine what it's like to have just a basic knowledge of how to translate something in a language you barely understand? And you're talking about complex legal terms, confusing on purpose legal stuff, but we use language to keep people from getting power, to keep people from living their authentic selves.
That does it for this episode of Marching On. For the ACLU of Kansas, I'm Micah Kubik. We'll be back next month for more conversations with the people working at the heart of the civil liberties movement in Kansas. Until next time, keep marching on.